I love getting to do that. One of these days, I'm really going to hit it. Thank you all for being here in this very cold and inclement weather. Maybe it's just no more. This is the biggest crowd we've ever had in here since I've been here. Let me call on Tony Gleason for our invocation.
Father, we're thankful to be a part of the WKU family and opportunities for learning and service and professional fulfillment and joy. We're grateful for our past and we're energized and optimistic about our future. We are just pray your blessings on this board, our president, and our vice president to determine and establish our strategic direction. We just pray for wisdom in every decision that's made here today. All these things we pray with confidence and thanksgiving. Amen.
Thank you, Tony. David Porter, I'll ask for the roll call, please.
Dr. Dennison?
Here.
Ms. Haskins?
Here.
Mr. Higdon?
Here.
Mr. Jesse?
Here.
Mr. Johnson?
Here.
Mr. Kennedy? Mr. Meyer?
Here.
Dr. Mentor?
Here.
Mr. Wilkie?
Here.
Mr. Zilke?
Thank you, David. At this time, I'd ask that we have a motion to approve the minutes of the fourth quarterly meeting. If there are any questions or additions or deletions to that,
motion to approve the minutes.
Okay, we have a motion. Have a second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Thank you so much. It's really, I don't know how bad it is out right now, but as it gets closer to the evening and the sun goes down, the roads could get a little bit worse. So I'm going to ask that we move along the best we can, although I'm not going to ask that we compromise the meeting. But let's let's move it along as quickly as we can to aid those who are traveling. We'll have to get back home later tonight. Right off now, let's go to academic affairs. Ms. Haskins.
Thank you. Good afternoon. In academic affairs, I don't know if we can approve these as a group or do we need to do them individually?
Yeah, I'd like to make a few remarks then.
Okay, that'd be fine.
First, a few remarks. For information purposes, we are currently engaged in completing our fifth-year midterm accreditation review for the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, or SACS. Which is it requires compliance with 14 principles, and I just report we are indeed in compliance with all 14, and also requires that we report and progress in our quality enhancement plan, which is engaging students to be citizen leaders in a global society, and I'm pleased to report that work is in progress and coming along very well. We have a few programs of action items today. I want to put these in context. Seems sometimes we are constantly bringing new programs for the board's approval, and that's a good thing. We're an evolving university. What's also significant in that context, and I did ask you about this, we have streamlined no less than 48 programs as part of the CPE's program productivity review, including 11 programs last year. So this is an evolving thing. So as we add new programs, we're also streamlining existing ones. And finally, and I do have a brief handout for this. We all know enrollment is increasing. That's a good thing. And there seems to be pressure to continue adding faculty to support that enrollment. Pleased to report that last year, although we had an enrollment increase, which is a good thing, the student-to-faculty ratio actually dropped. So it went from 19.3 to 19.1. Well, the faculty-student ratio increased. And this is the graph shows what I call honest statistics. The graph starts at zero. So the fact it's not terribly significant that's a drop, but it means that we are the faculty, the number of full-time equivalent faculty positions at Western Kentucky University is keeping pace with the enrollment growth. And with that,
I might add, yes. Gordon, by way of definition, the full-time equivalent students is a measure of full-time and part-time, and I believe the ratio is it takes 8 full-time and 2 part-time students to be, it takes 2 part-time to equal a full-time student in the measure of full-time equivalent.
Yes, the full-time student number, I believe, is at 17,000,
right,
which reflects a mix of true full-time students.
Unless anybody was confused by the number not being our reported enrollment of 20,903, That's the difference with the full-time, part-time variable.
And it takes
3 to 1.
Okay. Dr. Ansley, could you also define, while we're defining terms, of full-time faculty or full-time equivalent faculty?
Let's see. It's full-time faculty, tenure track faculty, plus one-third of part-time faculty.
So again, you said our faculty to student ratio is 19 point.
Student to faculty ratio.
Student
so
faculty,
there's 19 students per faculty member.
That's pretty low.
And we actually are, we hope that number will go even lower. In this case, low is good. Next year, we have several searches in progress that we will increase the faculty number.
Did we advertise that?
Hmm?
Is that advertised on when we send things out to students?
The ratio.
Sure,
ratio. I've never seen it. I don't know.
Not for all states, I mean, per se, but yes, there is an awareness.
That's a particularly important factor when we're competing with other larger universities or the universities that have a higher ratio. Some small private level arts colleges have a lower faculty student ratio, as you would guess. But internationally, that's a huge variable because you don't see that kind of a faculty-student ratio in most other countries where you have much, much larger kids. So that's a real point of attraction, particularly on the international stage.
Excuse me, also from the website, and CPE pushes it, so it is broadcast.
Okay. Thank you. We have several action items. The first is the requesting approval for a new degree type and academic program, a Master of Accountancy. And I have Stephen Wells and Dean Bob Reber. If you would, Steve.
Good afternoon. Traditionally, I've had a strong accounting undergraduate program. Last April, we '09, we received the separate accreditation from the AACSD, making Western one of only 171 universities in the world that had both the College of Business and its accounting program. We feel like this Master of Accountancy will simply enable our students to complete the 150 hours that they need to receive the CPA certificate when they take the exam.
Excellent.
Very good. Haskins, do you want to take that separately, or do you want to move on to number 2? And
I think we can move on.
We can approve them all at one time, Randy.
Unless someone wants to vote on one separately, you can't approve them all at once.
Okay. The second one is approval, and you've heard of this before, the DNP, the Doctor of Nursing Practice degree type and academic program. We're bringing the issue today because in the request to the Kentucky Board of Nurses and the CPE, approval of the institutional board is required on that form. We have Dr. Bennett, Director of the School of Nursing.
And we are bringing this to you today because actually our application is due to the Board of Nursing by Monday. So we are going to be looking forward to getting these minutes as soon as possible attached to our application. This program will allow us to produce the degree that our accrediting agency is recommending that all nurse practitioners have by 2015. And by 2015, if we make our goal of Monday, we will be on target to start producing our graduates at the DNP level by that day.
So it was the nursing faculty where I heard that resounding yes when we said we're going to go on and have the board meeting today.
Otherwise, it would be another year.
To address items 1.3 and 1.4, I invite Dr. Doris Sikora, department head for what is currently Consumer and Family Sciences.
Thank you. I have two items on the agenda. One is a child-life minor.
We did have a concentration with the child life specialist, and with the changes with the required graduation numbers lowering to 120, we actually tabled that. And so with the career being one of the top 11 careers right now, we really wanted to be able to provide students with the criteria that they needed to be able to have an internship in child life specialist programs. So we have actually put through a child life minor. That will allow students who actually have a family studies or a child studies degree to have the minor and then be able to, after graduation from Western, sit for the internship programs and for child life specialists. So that is the first item I have on the agenda. You want me to also address the second? The second one is a name change. And for some, it might be semantics because we are actually requesting to be changed from consumer and family sciences to family and consumer sciences. But we would like to actually do that name change so that we are in line with the rest of the nation and with our accrediting boards and bodies. And we have requested to do that effective April the 1st, so that be our first big kickoff, because 1911 to 2011 will be our 100-year anniversary. So that's our big kickoff, is to do the name change.
Okay. And last action item is the approval of 3 emeritus faculty appointments. So the names are on page 34 of your packet.
Okay, so we asked them for a motion to approve action item 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, and 1.5. Can I get a motion, please?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion carries. And we do have some information items.
We do.
And
Dale Bryan will present the enrollment report for spring.
Thank you. I think Julia gave you an updated report indicating we were down 22 during the winter term. At this point, as of last Monday, 118 down in regard to the upcoming semester, the spring semester, but we have reason to believe that the numbers are more than flatlining. So we feel like that we are going to have an increase. We've had the last couple of days, we had around 180 students to show up for APP, about 100 more than we expected. Also, we're receiving continuous calls regarding, is it too late for me to get in? So those are good calls. 20 called yesterday in regard to the schedule that we had not received anything on, so we feel like the numbers are showing positive. Any questions?
Comment, Dale. I think it's wonderful you can hold enrollment in the down economy, and great job.
Pleased with everything that's going on.
Give you all the credit, Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We're up. One of those new enrollees is particularly close to me, and I want to thank Dale and his staff for doing a great job. My daughter and I attended ATP yesterday.
Thank you. Good.
And it went flawlessly. You know, the advising, the things that they do for students, the program. Dr. Lee made a great presentation about what WKU was about. It was nice to experience that as a parent and for incoming students. They just did a great job.
Thank you. Do you take new students into the academy at the half break?
They come in on the annual.
Yes, on September. Well, that's good. Thank you.
The second information item is entitled the Teacher Leader Certification. We've gone through a fairly significant set of changes in our curricula for degrees leading to a teaching certificate. Here to explain that is Dean Sam Evans.
Thank you, Dr. Emsley. It is my pleasure to share some information with you in regards to the Teacher Leader Program that we have at the WKU. It is an endorsement tied in with the master's program as well as the planned fifth-year program. This was initiated originally probably about 4 years ago through several task force at the state level. there was concern about the relevancy of master's programs, not just in Kentucky, but across the country. So this was an effort to try and make sure that all of our students are appropriately prepared when they graduate from this program to make a difference in P-12 student learning. There's several things that I think are truly unique about our program compared to others in the Commonwealth. It is individualized based upon the students that are in our different classes and within the program. And to give you an idea as to what that means, we do look at their professional growth plan. All teachers out in schools have that growth plan, and it's designed to enhance their knowledge and skills. We also look at the Comprehensive School Improvement Plan, because it's not just what the teachers in the classroom are needing, but it's also what do the schools need to improve learning in that particular setting. There's other things that we'll be looking at, but those things are key in terms of trying to plan the program of study for each student. Now, if you look at a lot of our programs, they're set curriculum pretty much for everybody. That's not necessarily true in this program. And to give you one example of what we're doing, we are going to be working with the Hardin County Schools. A number of you may have heard some schools don't meet AYP. They have several of those. So we're probably going to start working with a cohort of about 25 middle school teachers. We're going to structure the program based upon what those schools need to do to meet AYP and what those individual teachers need to help them be successful in that particular endeavor. We know right now they need to focus on math, literacy, and working with special needs students. So once we get past the core, that's what we'll be working with these individuals on. And the true test, is this successful? Can we help get those schools to AYP? That is the intent of the work on the redesign, is to individualize it based upon the needs of the teachers and the schools to help all students be successful. And right now we think about college and career readiness. That is going to be the goal of some of the things we're working on. We started our first class winter term. There are 13 in that class, which for winter term is not bad enrollment. Spring semester, we're going to have 24 in the intro class, and right now we've got 20 in another class. This is offered by web, so that does limit the number that we put in each of the classes, and this will continue to increase as students come into the program. And there may be students in other courses connected with the program, but we feel we're off to an excellent start in terms of the program, and I feel very good about the potential for us to truly make a difference in learning out in the schools. Willing to entertain any questions?
I was reading an article not long ago that said that the one school in particular that they were testing was like, had a 92% achievement rate. But of those 92%, they were only reading at like 50% or less than that. And when they got to college, they were not college ready and had to take remedial classes. And it was a big blow to some of those kids who thought that they were really ready for college. This program that you're doing at Hardin County,
right,
will that kind of address that and help get those kids more ready to participate and not just have the school think they're doing great and actually not?
Absolutely. In other words, to help all students get at grade level or above. So when we look at the different assessments that they have to go through, those kids will be successful. When they graduate, they're ready to come to WKU. They will not have to take developmental courses. Mm-hmm. That is the goal that we're going to be shooting for, to make sure all teachers are prepared mm-hmm. to do what they need to do to help students in the classroom. So they're going to look at literacy as one of the areas which apparently they already know is the weakness.
Yeah, reading and writing is
Dr. Evans, I already know these folks, but I see a couple of the master teachers in the room. I wonder if you could introduce them to the board and talk a little bit about what they do.
On that, Blaine's going to take care of that on the next,
next
agenda item.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As you know, page 37, 330 students are involved in the programs affected by this change.
particular of interest, of course, are, you know, the STEM disciplines and making sure that there are teachers out there well-versed in science, technology, engineering, and math into that. And there's a program called SkyTeach. It's a joint program between the Ogden College of Science and Engineering and the College of Education Behavioral Sciences and Dean Blaine Farrell.
Thank you.
Which is it?
It's a pleasure to be able to have the opportunity to present this program to you. It's been in operation now for 3 years, and I will introduce the master teachers. This program, SkyTeach, is really a replicate of a program at the University of Texas at Austin called UTeach, which is a nationally recognized program for science and math teacher preparation. Now, ExxonMobil put in $120 million to replicate this in 12 sites. So we were one of the first applicants to put in, and we were one of the first 12 sites selected, and we were only one of two comprehensive universities that received this grant, and we're now the poster child. And I'm going to let the master teachers present this, but I want to introduce the PI. Scott Bonham is not here today, but we do have the two co-directors from the College of Education, Martha Day, and from the College of Science and Engineering, we have David Urbach. The backbone of this program, and the master teachers are the ones that really make it work. And the master teacher is Melissa Woodloff from Ogden, and we have Rico Tyler from the College of Education. So this truly is a joint collaborative program. And we're going to have two students that present to you, because I feel as though the passion comes best from where it actually hits the road. And so we have Amar Patel and we have Joy Beth Spinks that are going to be presenting to this body, and I hope you enjoy what they have to say. It's been very successful. I'll tell you, we have follow-on funding. We got a Robert Noyce scholarship for $900,000 to provide stipends. We have another grant, a math-science partnership, which identified, by the way, the disconnect. And the disconnect is students are memorizing their way through high school, and they're not getting insight learning. So we just submitted a $10 million grant to not wait. I don't want to wait for these students. The first graduates are this year. We're going to go into the middle schools and train the teachers to do the inquiry base that they'll talk about. So I'll turn that over to the mayor.
Through this program, Blaine, how much have we grown the number of students majoring in these disciplines from what it was before?
I'll tell you that. It goes basically from about 30 on average before to 249, and we're way ahead of our projections. I'll let that tell you that.
I think so. PowerPoint, right? Mm-hmm. You have a presentation?
Yeah.
We turned it in.
We should be here.
If not,
we have
a spare.
It's not on that one. We don't have it.
We don't have it?
We sent it. Okay.
Okay, what's hooked up to the screen here? Jeff, can you... this is my drive.
You've got a thumb drive. We can make it work.
Thank you. Thumb drive.
Obviously named?
Yes.
That's a fair question.
Well, thank you very much for having us. My name is Melissa Rudloff, and I'm a master teacher with the Scouting Program. It's a real privilege to get to be here with you. We're going to take about 10 minutes of your time and share with you an overview of the program. So when you hear the term SkyTeach, it's not something ambiguous or something unknown to you, but something that you will have really been able to identify with. We also have our two students that will share sort of a vignette, a little insight in the aspects of the program where we're meeting the challenges in teacher education. So we really do feel like it's a privilege to be with you today. To give you a little background as we pull up the PowerPoint, I come by way of teaching. First of all, I'm an alum of WKU, so I'm all about Go Big Red. And it was a privilege to get to go to Western many moons ago, even though I was really young. It's been a long time. And I got to teach in a local high school in the area of physics and math for about 13, 14 years. And then had some other varied things that I've done, and then got hooked back into Western with Rico, my comrade here. And both of us come from teaching in high school in the math and science disciplines. And so that's where our heart is working with students, and now helping students who want to work with those students learn how to do it best. So that gives you a little bit of background from us. And I'm sure we'll have a PowerPoint.
Any
minute now. Not that we're totally PowerPoint driven.
The presentation name. Let
me go help
with that. Yeah. Imagine if you will.
Exactly. We can do that if we have to. Although we would like you to see some of the statistics.
We're almost
there. Great. Thanks.
And there are some summary page 38 if you want to read along.
Summary start with a little quiz for you. And the little quiz is this. What do these numbers have in common? Any guesses?
2 digits.
They have 2 digits. Very good. He's on it. Wow.
Math major
speaking. Well,
rocket science. What these numbers have, in common is they're actually a tiny little sketch of the state of Kentucky. Kentucky ranks 39th. You're supposed to press the button for me.
Now, I didn't say we were teaching technology, okay?
Kentucky ranks 39th in industry investment in research and development. We rank 42nd in the nation in the number of high-tech jobs, and we rank 47th in the number of scientists and engineers.
Oh, Lord. Now, if you let that sink in just a little bit.
It's in the good news part of the
this year. Isn't the good news part.
No.
But if you look at those numbers, then it has to make you think why. And we are avid believers that part of the reason why those numbers are so dismal is really related to a single-digit number. And that single-digit number describes the number of teachers that are coming out of Kentucky's universities that are prepared to teach math, physics, chemistry, biology, earth space science, middle grade science, and middle grades math. For example, last year, only 4 biology teachers were produced by Western Kentucky University. Only 4. And that was the highest number since 2006. Let that sink in for just a moment.
So the real secret to improving science, technology, engineering, and math is how do we recruit, retain better qualified science and math teachers? If that doesn't happen, then nothing else will happen.
So with the question being, how do you do that? One way is to find successful programs and then learn from those successes and replicate those successes. And Western has had the privilege of finding one of those programs, as Dean Farrell said, and getting the opportunity to replicate with ExxonMobil's support. And that program is founded at the University of Texas, Austin, called UTeach. A partnership between the education and the STEM faculty designed an intensive program. They began aggressively recruiting mathematics and science majors to become teachers, and they started in 1997 with 28 students. The UTeach program has grown to over 450 students, and currently they're graduating around 70 students a year that are prepared to be math and science teachers. Now, even better than that, because if you know anything about teaching, the retention rate in teaching is not high. 50%, 4 years later, are still in the classroom. But of those who entered teaching 4 years ago that go through the UTeach program, approximately 82% are teaching 4 years later. So that's a good success rate to try to replicate.
In 2007, Western Kentucky University was awarded a $2.4 million UTeach replication grant. Our version of UTeach is called SkyTeach, and currently we're in the middle of our third year of operation, which means we have 3 years of data to sort of see what our progress is so far.
Now, in the third year of, go back. It gets a little excited. There we go. Let's go back. There we go. This is what we're very excited about. So this is the good news part, okay? In the third year of the UTeach program, if you look at the orange line, that's the UTeach program. In their third year, so around 2000, they had 60 students in their program. They projected that in Western's third year of us replicating their program, we would have around 140 students. But in our third year right now, our actual SkyTeach enrollment is 249 students that are actively enrolled in SkyTeach courses currently.
And furthermore, the students that we have show pretty good progress. Our students have an ACT score that's about 4 points higher than the average, well, 5 points higher than the average WKU student. And if you look at their GPAs, SkyTeach students have a higher GPA.
We may not have any technology skills, but
they
we have
higher GPA than the average Ogden student or the average College of Education student.
Right. So SkyTeach attracts these students by addressing some critical needs. And that's what we really want to share with you, those challenges to teacher education, how SkyTeach meets those challenges and allow the students to share a little bit about that. First of all, challenge number one in teacher education nationally and even internationally is that teacher education is too big a task to be handled by just one college. So SkyTeach does a great job of collaboration. It's a joint program, as we said, between the Ogden College of Science and Engineering and the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences. And so Dean Farrell and Dean Evans provide support and leadership and funding to build SkyTeach into what it's been. SkyTeach also provides, both colleges actually provide faculty to the SkyTeach program. And the use of master teachers is critical. And you see both of us here, but we represent a cohort of right now currently 5 master teachers that work with the students. We're experienced classroom teachers, so we're literally coaches to these students. From the beginning through the entire process of birthing a teacher is really a coaching process that we get to be part of. Furthermore, the SkyTeach program allows these students to be double majors. And the first major will be in their content area, mathematics, chemistry, biology, and their second major is in science, math, education. And yes, it's doable in 4 years to do both these majors.
The second challenge is how do we actually recruit students to enter into this program? Well, it begins with the freshman class. We have an extensive recruitment program that covers, essentially, if you're a freshman coming to Western, you will talk to somebody, usually Melissa, at some point before you start taking classes. And we encourage them into our special introductory course just for those freshmen. We don't let them get away from us, so we have to do it as a freshman. In that course, they will go into the field and start teaching. There's nothing else that will make a teacher than to teach early and often. Once we recruit these students in, that incoming group becomes a cohort, and that cohort works together, they teach together, they have a set of common experiences that keep them tied to us for the 4 years that it takes for us to pull them through the program. We provide them with scholarships and financial support. We provide them with internships. We have SkyTeach workrooms, SkyTeach computers, SkyTeach equipment. We keep it all in-house as we take them through the program. And throughout that entire 4 years, they're being mentored, they're being advised, they're being taken care of by this group of what's now 5 teachers. And all 5 of us are former high school or middle school science or math teachers. So we've actually been in the field. We share with them that practical experience. What does it take to be a teacher, to be successful? And of course, I can talk about it all I want to, but more importantly, I have a student in the SkyTeach program here to sort of speak to that for us.
Hi, my name is Joy Beth Spinks, and I'm a senior in the SkyTeach program right now. So I'm almost done with the program. I'll be student teaching in the fall semester in biology. And I just wanted to give you kind of my personal experience with the support that I've received from SkyTeach. Last spring semester, with my partner, we gave our first high school biology lesson, and it was our first chance to actually be in the content and the grade that we wanted to teach in. So it was a great experience, and we actually gave a lesson over photosynthesis. And a couple of days before we were supposed to teach our lesson, our activity for our lesson wasn't working out the way we wanted it to. And we had so much support from not only the staff of SkyTeach getting us the materials that we needed for our activity, even if we changed it at the last minute, but also Ms. Reedlaw came in on a Sunday night, helped us get it all together. We were so stressed out, she was there to calm us down. And it was just a great experience having her there for support. And the great thing about the SkyTeach program is that it's not just a program of study. We've really created a professional learning community that is going to be critical to our success even after we graduate. Because I know that I can call anyone from the program up and ask for ideas, ask for support, help, anything that I need. And that's probably been the best part of SkyTeach for me. In addition, Dr. Farrell mentioned the Noyce Scholarship. I'm also a recipient of that. So that's been great to have the financial support in addition to the mentoring, the supplies that we need. And it's just been a great experience for me and Scott teaching. I can't wait to actually get in to student teaching and be there full time every day to use those skills that I've learned these past few years.
The next challenge, once we get these students into our program, is how do we actually keep them in the field teaching? And we start that, I mentioned earlier, we have an introductory freshman program. It's called Step 1 and Step 2. It's two courses that together form an introductory sequence. For most teacher education students, their introductory course is a lecture-based class taught when they're sophomores or juniors, and their only real experience being in a classroom is when they go to observe. Step 1 and Step 2 takes a completely different approach. The only goal of Step 1 and Step 2 is to take every single one of our freshmen and have them prepare, practice, and actually teach 5 to 6 lessons in local classrooms with real students. Nothing else will recruit students better, and nothing else will retain them. Not a single one of our freshmen is anything other than terrified to be an 18-year-old in a classroom full of students. But more important than the fact that they're terrified is the fact that they're more excited about it than they are terrified. And that tells you, more than anything else will tell you, whether you want to be a teacher. The problem is not getting large numbers of students. It's giving them the experience that lets them know that teaching is what they want to do. And to sort of share some of that with you, we have another one of our students with us, Amar Patel.
Hello, my name is Amar Patel. I'm a chemistry major, and I'm currently in as a senior at Western. And I have had about 10 to 15 opportunities to be in the classroom and teach students, all the way from elementary school kids to high schoolers. I just want to share some experiences that I've had in the high school. Last spring, I taught with my partner a physics class. Now, I'm not a physics person by any means. Mr. Love had to help me through the entire process with me and my partner. And I feel like because I did a physics lesson, I grew the most during that class. Before coming into Sky Teach, I was under the impression a teacher, you know, you get your training, you get your education, you go into the classroom, you teach the students. I didn't really realize what the word teach meant. And after that semester, I have received so much support, so much help, and so much mentoring from my master teachers, as well as from my high school mentor teacher. I had to help kids with the idea of physics, and I couldn't really do that if I didn't understand it myself. So I spent days and hours just practicing different things, reading different books, just to figure out what I need to teach them, how I could teach them, and understand it myself. Because a student doesn't want a teacher who doesn't know what they're talking about. So at that point, we taught our lessons, they all went great. But that class told us that we needed to analyze what we've done. We had to watch videos of what we did, write papers, figure out what we did wrong, what we did good, how to make them better. So the main thing that I got out of that entire experience was that teacher is not there just to regurgitate information. There's more teaching. You never stop learning. When you're a teacher, you constantly have to learn new topics. And I'm glad that I didn't walk into teaching realizing this is all. I know everything I need to know, and I'm just ready to spit it out to the students. So that experience has probably been the greatest experience in this program.
Let me click it one or two more times for me.
Let me ask a question.
Yes.
First, I like what you all are doing. I mean, that's bound to be great, especially for a person when they get ready to do the student teaching. They've already been exposed. But you must do you have some kind of a system or a relationship with the schools to
yes.
be able to how's that work?
Absolutely, and I think that's another strength of having the master teachers in the program. Not that I'm about job security right now, but we are important because we do have relationships out in the local and regional schools. One, we've been there, and two, we've built the bridges and relationships with superintendents, principals, and the teachers that are in the disciplines that we're placing students. And so now, in most any school that you walk into, at least in Warren County and then around the edges right now, you can walk in and say Sky Teach, and principals and teachers will know, oh, that's right, they're out here in the field, they're coaching those students. Those students are coming into my classroom and working in my classroom, and I love what they do. And that's been very positive, too. The feedback from teachers who have come alongside of the Amars and the Joy Best have said, I love what they're doing. because we build on inquiry-based model of teaching, that it's about getting students to do science and math to really understand science and
we
math.
Select the classrooms that our students go into are pre-selected by us. We look for teachers that have been highly successful in teaching math or science and want to be mentors, want to work with students, want to do things with them. Every time one of our students teaches, before the lesson, we have prepped them for it, and they have practiced that lesson. We don't let anybody teach in our name until we're ready for them to teach. But on the other side, that teacher in the classroom is going to set them down immediately after the class and actually go over the lesson with them. What are the high points? What are the low points? And essentially, they're going through the same process that they'll go through when they graduate, when they go through their internship. But they're starting it 4 years early.
So it appears you all are being well received. From the high schools in our area and maybe some of the elementaries and whatever. Great program.
To conclude this, and this is also good news, the first SkyTeach graduating class is going to be this spring. We have our first little crop of student teachers that have started and have worked through, but it's very quickly growing.
They're across the street right now waiting for us to come back.
Exactly. Current enrollment and retention rates predict that SkyTeach will have over 400 graduates by 2017. So in the schools in this region and the state, by 2017, which will be two blinks of an eye, we'll be able to walk into schools and say, you have SkyTeach graduates here, don't you? And that's going to be really exciting to see. As a point of comparison, because we have to be a little prideful, WKU is the second smallest university among the replication sites, but we have the second largest enrollment in our program. And so when Dean Farrell complimented us as being a poster child for UTeach, it's true. We've gotten that feedback from UTeach that we really are an exemplary program of the replication sites. There's also a G-SkyTeach. There is a graduate alternative certification program that's based on SkyTeach called G-SkyTeach. It was funded and started last summer. There's currently 14 students that are Western Kentucky University graduate students in the Jefferson County schools currently teaching through their first year right now. And they went through intensive summer training, and then throughout this year they are continuing their coursework and will at the end of this year then have finished their, in a sense, student teaching year and coursework and have a master's degree and be G-SkyTeach graduates. And MTSU and UT Knoxville that are nearby that have been chosen in a second round of replication sites have looked to us and received help from us, have actually visited and needed some guidance and some help. So we've been able to be a beacon in this area of the United States for these replication sites.
So there are originally 12 sites selected by ExxonMobil,
yes,
by the National Math and Science,
yes,
Initiative, which is funded by ExxonMobil.
And then
we were one of those,
right,
and I think one of only two in the Southeast,
exactly,
of the United States at the time. So in round two,
Eight more were selected.
So there are a total of 20 now.
Right.
Well, actually, four in Tennessee, and the government is paying for them. They're not waiting for a grant.
Right.
The state government in Tennessee?
Right. Tennessee was, two of their sites were selected in the from UTeach, from NIMSI, the National Math and Science Initiative, that's sort of the broker of that.
Mm-hmm.
And because those two sites, all four sites in Tennessee have gone after it, the governor stepped up and provided funding to say, we're going to do this in all four sites.
How about that? That's impressive.
But they've also looked to us for some guidance and help.
Well, the point that you'll hear me say this often, but I go back to what I said at lunch. This is another example of a faculty taking the initiative, seizing a national opportunity, being successful enough to get the grant and to be selected. And if you're looking for definitions of a leading American university, this is as good an example as we have of doing that in a relevant context of the desperate need for math and science teachers in our public schools. I mean, this will change education, and it's creating teacher scholars, and. You know, we produce more elementary, middle grade, secondary education teachers, Sam, than anyone else in Kentucky, and our rate on the practice exam exceeds anyone else, any other university in Kentucky. But what this is doing, it's creating scholars who are engaged in undergraduate research, who are doing things that have historically been hard to find in a typical elementary, middle grade, or secondary education teacher. And this is a profound program.
That concludes our formal presentation, but we are happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I have one comment on the GTEACH, the one for the graduates. Are you able to go back into schools in our region and then to get people that are already biology teachers or math teachers or whatever and get them back and retrain them?
Well, GSkyTeach specifically focuses on students that are recent graduates typically that have mathematics, chemistry, or physics degrees but had no teacher training. And so that's what GSkyTeach started, and that's why it's an alternative certification route. But students or teachers that are currently teaching in schools, the grant that we're pursuing right now that will model SkyTeach and really take SkyTeach currently into the schools, we're really waiting to hear right now. We feel like we have a really good chance of having a SkyTeach version that is school teach. I don't know what we're going to call it.
There were 24 superintendents and principals and teachers that stood up and signed on to that immediately. We had to turn some away because we could only handle 24 schools. But to get that much commitment in a very short period of time was pretty amazing. And that's through the Green River Regional Education
Board. Yeah. If the NSF funds the proposal, we'll put master teachers in essentially, I think by the end of the five-year program, we'll have 30 schools.
24 experimental and 24 control, and then we'll be able to check to see if it makes a difference.
But they'll be working with the teachers in those schools, doing the same kind of instruction, teaching them the same sort of things that we train our own SkyTeach students to do.
And Catherine, I believe we're pretty close to matching the $1 million challenge private gift goal that ExxonMobil presented to us in terms of individual private donors who are making private gifts to match the ExxonMobil funding that are bringing teachers, for example, in Allen County to ensure that Allen County is included, because that was one of the terms of the private gift which came from Allen County to support this program.
Well, I'd also like to commend our two students who did an excellent job. Thank you.
I have lots of comments. I mean, this is wonderful. I mean, I think having children and knowing, you know, they just need good science and math teachers, and it's been a problem, and this is just going to change lots of things. Can you tell me the difference in this program and something called Teach America? And then my other question is you said when do you get these kids? Do you get them when they're freshmen, and are they coming in saying, I want to teach? I mean,
I'll address the second question, and then as far as a Teach for America comparison, I'll let you all handle that. But let me say that I tend to be the first face they see representing SkyTeach, and here's really what happens, and Dean Farrell can vouch for this. When ATP happens, that you just recently went through, a student that's interested in something in the sciences or math comes through Ogden College, and after the day of ATP, they end up on top of the hill to meet with Dean Farrell, who gives a few minutes welcome to Ogden College, and then sends them with an advisor to register for classes. At that moment, I get an opportunity to plant the seed, and what the seed is that's planted is, you may or may not know what you want to do in science or math. Obviously, you have an interest because you've come to this college, but here's something I'd like to share with you as an opportunity, and the opportunity is that you could try out a career option in your very first semester here. No prerequisite. You get to actually start a class and within 5 weeks be out in a classroom teaching real students a hands-on math or science lesson. And you'll find out very quickly if that energizes you and you love it, or if, goodness gracious, I have a new appreciation for what teaching is, but maybe it's not a good fit for me. Mm-hmm. So in a very first semester, very first class, no prerequisites, you get to experience what it's like to teach.
Melissa,
and that's the hook.
A market speaker, this too, because I think you're kind of classic in that
sort of situation. Exactly.
Before I came to Western in the fall of 2015, up until about 2008, I was dead set on going to UK. UK was where I wanted to go. I wanted to major in chemistry. Then I heard a little bit from my chemistry teacher about the chemistry program here, and it's the best in the state, so I was like, nobody offers this, but UK is where my heart is. That's where I want to go.
And then that same teacher, I don't know if she met with Mr. Powell or not, but she came to my house and brought me a brochure on Skyteach. And after I read through it, I was like, I'm definitely going to Western. So I came to Western, and from there, I was still on the fence on whether I wanted to teach or go into medicine, and I'm still on the fence about it. But this program has shown me, you know, the stuff that you learn in teacher education, whether you'd like to be a teacher or not, it's going to help you wherever you go. So it's been such a great program, it hasn't turned me away from teaching. So I'm still excited about it, and I can't wait to see what happens. I'm kind of scared to see what happens.
We do a lot of stealth recruiting.
Exactly. But we do. We cast a very wide net at ATP, and besides that, we're present at every a focus on Western weekend. Every time we're out there and we're looking at people and saying, so you're interested in science or math, have you thought about teaching? Then there's people who come along and say, I thought about teaching and I like math. But those people are fewer and far between than the people who just know that they either like science or math, but they're not sure what they're going to do with it. And that's where we're able to say, why don't you try this class? And that's our recruitment tool right there. It's that one-on-one contact with talking it up and seeing parents and students at all the Western events that we can be at. Then the Teach for America question, how it compares.
I believe, and Sam will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Teach America is started in Princeton. I believe that they get the college students and went through an alternative route for certification so they could go out and teach, and they spend a two-year stint, and then they may go do something else. Some of them may stay teaching, but they do an excellent job because they're some of the best and brightest. But this program, we go for the best and brightest, but they get trained, and they have a lot more work in the preparation on how to be a teacher than they do for the teacher.
Just speak a little bit about the scholarships.
There's a variety of ways that we support our students. We've been able to partner now and have the NOIS scholarships that are specific to teaching, teacher scholarships. But we've also been able to provide some SkyTeach scholarships with some of our funding. And then we've had like Allen County step up and say, we want to be a partner with SkyTeach, and we're going to fund some students that are Allen County students that want to pursue SkyTeach.
That will come back there to teach.
Absolutely, and then we'll go back into their community there and teach. So there's been a variety of different size scholarships from different sources. And we've also been able to provide some financial support to some of our students by giving them some internship opportunities, working in the local science museum, working with some local schools in their math teams that they're building for mathematics competitions that they do.
We have students who go to the Governor's Scholars Program each summer and actually teach with science teachers at the Governor's Scholars Program, trying to get them more experience actually working with teachers and teaching real students.
Have you been able to add many males? Because we need men in
teaching. Yes, absolutely. I think one of the most outstanding ones is student teaching right now this semester, who's just going to be a phenomenal science teacher at middle school level, who's a male. But yes, and we have several. I don't know what our ratio is. But it's not real disparate. I mean, it's not a real big discrepant number between males and females.
Well, I think from the number of questions and comments that you've gotten from this board, it's evident that y'all are doing a great job, and it's a great program. And I don't mean to step on any toes when I say this, but this is one of the best presentations that I've seen since I've been on this board. Y'all are doing very, very good. Good job.
I think we practiced this.
Practice what you preach.
There's a few in the room that know that the CPE and the Education Committee for the Legislature has gotten iterations on this presentation. So you're in good company.
Yeah.
Good job. I would share with you that the Committee on Education, the Senate Education Committee, said the same thing you said. It was one of the best presentations they had ever seen before their committee.
Well, it was very, very well done, and you've done a great job.
We're talking about the need for teachers in the STEM disciplines, but what is that need? Obviously, a big part of what we're trying to do is avoid brain drain. You want to produce people who will teach in Kentucky.
Right.
So when this first cohort goes out, do you predict 100% employment? How many vacancies are you looking at in the Commonwealth?
That's a great question.
Well, it's hard that we have people coming from Florida,
yeah,
Nashville,
yeah,
all over the country.
So they'll go back. They may go back.
There won't be a problem.
What he's saying is we have Florida who's contacted us to come up and recruit our students. We have Nashville now that's Metro Schools that wants to come up and recruit our students.
Right.
And I'm all Kentucky, so I'm all about, but Kentucky's
that's
a great
fine,
place.
That's fine, but keep as many in Kentucky as you
exactly.
can.
Exactly, I'm all
our
about that.
Our superintendents aren't asleep either. They're
no, our superintendents right. are chomping at the bit. So I'd like to step out and say that 100% of our students that graduate this spring will have jobs, and I really feel like I can safely say that.
And I look forward to having you all come back to the board and talk to us about it when you've got some numbers.
Yeah.
Great. Excellent. With or without the PowerPoint.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you all. Good job.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
The academic
affairs
report.
Thank you, Dr. Emslie, and all of you for that great report. And I think this board was fully amazed and truly interested in what's going on here at WKU. So that'll end the academic affairs meeting. Items, and we'll turn it back over to our chair.
Thank you so much, Yvette. Good job once more. Let's slip into the executive committee now. We've got no action items, but some couple of three or four information items. John, you're up. Construction progress update, please, sir.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. Typically, we provide you a progress report on construction at your meetings with a printed version in your agenda, as well as we try to have some photographic images for you to give you an update. We will cover only five projects with you today. Advance that. There we go. We're going to cover the new College of Education, Gary A. Ransdell Hall, Carroll National Conference Center, the Music Hall, progress on high voltage infrastructure project, as well as acquaint you with a few of the renovation projects that's going on campus. I put this slide in there because I thought you might find this of interest. This is a slide of a photograph, of an aerial photograph from 2004. And that's the site of the Gary Ransdell Hall in the corner here between Regents on the left and Normal above. And go ahead and put this in there. Now you see in 2010 something that is brand new in that. Well, there's been a dramatic change in the structure of the campus in just a relatively short period of time. But you also see that we now have an updated 2010 aerial of the campus. And it's not just this section of the campus, but in our master plan update presentation, we will update you on how we have the entire campus now updated with an aerial photograph from 2010. And when I happened to see this and look at the difference between the two, I just thought it would be of interest for you to see it. Boy, what 4.5 years has been. This particular project, as successful as it is, has taken us 4.5 years. And in July of 06, it was approved by the General Assembly as part of House Bill 380. As part of the 2006-08 biennial budget. Immediately after that, we hit the ground running, and a month later, we had our consultants on board. Ross Torrent Architects were selected the next month. Within a period of 2 years, it took us 2 years to do what was described here as programming, design, land acquisition, site preparation, and bidding for the project. We awarded a construction project in October of 08 and began construction. And another 2 years went by of construction to build this beautiful building. And as you saw on your tour in October of this year, we toured the building when it was substantially complete. We started moving in November. And Dr. Evans, I'm confident, would tell you that we are ready for classes as a result. Next Monday. So we will have classes in this facility next week.
I had heard
that. You didn't see from before?
I was just going to say, John, I got a little bird told me that Dr. Sam Evans was already moving stuff in his office the other day.
I'm ready to go. My office is ready. Faculty offices are ready.
So. All right.
They started moving in December. Yeah. We toured it with
they're
you
in
October. They started moving in November, December. And this month in January was the big move in with all the new equipment arriving and all the setup that was due. And now it's basically ready to go. I wanted to show you some of these shots. When you toured the building in October, you didn't see rooms that were ready. I wanted you to see that we have rooms ready for classes on Monday. And given that this is a LEED certified building, it's going to be a LEED certified building, or better, it will be evaluated within a year. We have to prove ourselves. Following the construction, following the completion, it's been designed to perform at a certain standard. Well, LEED certification means you have to document and prove it through measurement and verification that the building actually performs as designed. Once that happens, then we would be categorized as either certified, and then there's four levels. There's certified, there's silver, and there's gold and platinum. So we think we're going to be in the silver category. Yes, sir.
Remind us again of how many trailer truckloads of furniture and fixtures you brought in.
How many was that?
38 truckloads, started November the 4th, and the company that's assembled and putting all it together is actually finishing this afternoon with a few details and classrooms. So they've assured us that they will be ready and we'll have classes on Monday.
Sam shaking his head. I walked through the building earlier this week myself just to see, and I was pleased with the fact that the classrooms, although there are with any new building that we've ever done, going to be items that are going to have to be addressed. We refer to them as punch list items. We are working on those items. But between now and when we dedicate the building in April, we will still do what I call very minor finishes and punch list items that really have what I think will be an outstanding dedication day, where the building is at that point with all the finishing details in place. I mean, we got a functional, complete building now, but we will finish those minor details between now and dedication. The next project is the Carroll Nicely Phase 3 project, which was a $2.5 million renovation for the building. You've heard us talk about it before. It principally is doing exterior elements to improve the building. Here you see the porte-cochere that's in construction. It will be a new grand entrance, a storage area that was being added on the back of the building in that area. And there's also even going to be an outdoor patio area that they will use for their various functions when the building gets completed. This work is probably a little bit behind schedule because of our weather, but we will be completing it this spring. I'll let Brian Russell update us on the music building, Music Hall.
Our next project is the Music Hall. It's located directly behind our Fine Arts Center. It's also going to be the entrance is going to be off of Normal, where we go up the turn up to State Street. What's interesting about this project is no good building starts without a solid foundation. This project has had 3 weeks of continuous blasting, which that part of the project I'm glad to say is over. And they blasted 2 to 3 times per day to remove rock so that we could get into a position so that we could actually start putting in the foundation for this structure. This now has cleared the way for us to get started. And we have really made a large impact on that area to get us going. We are on schedule, and we still are targeted to be complete in December of this year. Some of our photographs are so large. But it's really been a big transition for that project. Our next project is our high voltage infrastructure project, which we have been working on for many years. I'm proud to say during this phase that we have now completed the north loop of our high voltage project. And you say, well, what does that mean to us as an institution? What it means to us as an institution is that before we were very vulnerable to the weather into aging infrastructure and substations that if the power went down on the top of our hill, we had no way of repowering up buildings. With the completion of the North Loop, if the power goes down, we can change some switches, we can backfeed buildings, and get the students back into the classes faster. We've also done something that I think is really important to our hill, is going up and down State Street. If you'll notice on the left and on the right, we have brand new, large, appropriately sized sidewalks to get our students up and down the hill. We didn't have that before. We had one sidewalk on the right-hand side. So the digging and the disruption is completed. But what's nice is that as soon as the weather warms up, we'll have asphalt trucks and companies back open. We will finish the new realignment down Mimosa Alley, which a lot of us are familiar with, and that'll complete the disruptive side of that project. With that project, we have some new, in conjunction with our ESPC project, we're adding some new high-efficiency chiller systems in a couple of plants. We'll be putting online approximately 4 to 5 new buildings onto our new high-voltage phase of our project. We also got completed in this phase a new 2010 master plan, which gives the university direction for finishing up the south loop of our project. And as funding becomes available, that south loop will get completed, and it'll be a huge improvement for our infrastructure with our electric. Again, when they put it in the first, it's over 40 years old, so it'll really give us a lot more.
South Loop is? Could you just define what the South Loop is?
South Loop is basically from the northeast corner of the residence halls all the way down Normal, okay, all the way up University Drive, and back up toward, I would say, the new substations over on the left, which I've called a service supply building.
Okay. Thank you.
These next pictures are before and after pictures. We don't talk a lot about renovation projects, but through the year, we have a renovation group in our department. It's headed up by Natasha Smith, Alfonso, Victoria. They typically are doing somewhere between $700,000 to $900,000 worth of classroom improvements. Want to show you all some of these. This happens to be at South Campus before. Softened up the area, added some new furniture and carpeting. Just continually improving areas. This is a biology lab and has been converted per somebody's request into a computer area. This classroom here is continually, we are updating our audio visual components of our classrooms. It helps to put the information. We also have the Helm Library area. I don't know if everybody is familiar with our entrance and our, but we have a Confucius Studies exhibit and program that has been started on our campus. These are some conceptual renderings of the space that we are now currently modifying. These conceptual drawings or renderings are going to be in the Helm Library, where the old basketball arena was.
Can you preserve the circle? That's kind of cool. A little jump circle in the middle.
I don't think it goes away.
Yeah, no, actually it's beyond where the Chinese Learning Center will be, and it will stay in that reference area of the library.
Okay.
That was the existing space. This is during construction where they've gone in, started painting. They put in all new lighting, all new high-efficiency lighting. And there's the old gym floor, a piece of that. And that is to be completed in by May of this year. A lot of hard work.
Hey, you see the jump circle going to the left there.
I see it. Yeah. No, that's a great little relic. Yes. The gym floor holds up well, doesn't it?
And not so well on some
not
spots.
Not so well. You really get looking at it.
So that concludes our instruction presentation on some featured projects. We have other projects and things. We're working on a lot of other things on campus, but those are some that we thought you all might have some immediate interest in.
Brian, quick question. I know that I've seen it before, but where you put in that new sidewalk going mm-hmm. down where State Street and mostly connect, and where is the road going to reconnect with State Street right there?
It is a new entrance off of our Mimosa Alley. What we've done is taken a very wide area that we're basically having students cross over in front of automobiles and made it a normal intersection. And so it's brought the sidewalks much closer together with a typical stop sign. So it just continues from north, our normal street, directly onto State Street, just like it is today. The car routing, some of the other things is that we have narrowed by putting in the sidewalks and by narrowing streets. What that does is it's a method of calming our traffic. So it actually will slow the traffic down by pulling in the streetscape. It also has eliminated some of the cars that park up and down that street, which only gives us place for students to get between cars and then pop out in front of traffic. So it should be much safer. And I'm sure lots of us have seen some of the pedestrian crossing signs that are out in the middle of the street that are a lot more visible. To help identify to our visitors to campus that we have areas that we are trying to get our students to walk across. Should help us.
That concludes our report, Mr. Zane. Any questions?
That's it.
All
right. Thank you. Thank you once more. Always a good and informative. Next, we're going to have a development update. But before we do that, I want to officially welcome Catherine Costello. She's already been welcomed, and we've already met her, and most of you know her, but this is the first time she will have addressed the board here. So welcome to today, and we'll be delighted to hear from you.
Thank you so much. Is this...
Yes. Yeah, actually, we're going to do a master plan update, but... It's
either way. We can do that after she does hers.
Y'all are sitting there. Why don't y'all finish up with the master
excuse
plan?
Excuse me. I got ahead of John when you said you were complete. I'll give you a double dose there.
Catherine, we really need your help. So
yeah. She'll probably help you out, John.
Deck. Yeah. Well, we were complete with our construction report, and we can move into our master plan update report.
Very good.
I think I sent to you in your packets a article that appeared in the Spirit magazine from 2006, written by Tommy Newton. And I want to compliment him again on that summary of the master plans across the university. If you may have noticed that, and if you had read it, you would have noticed that the first master plan for Western was conducted in 1909 at the request of Dr. Cherry by Henry Wright. And since that time, the university has been engaged in many campus updates of the master plan. And more notably, the more official dates that the master plan was actually updated was in 1966, 75, 1990, and the most recent update of the university master plan was in 2003. Well, it wasn't that long ago Dr. Ransdell came to me and said that his map in the president's conference room and his other materials that we were using from 2003 had gotten out of date, even though we had on more than one occasion updated his map to try to stay current. This campus has gone through so much modification and addition and change in the last few years that we needed to update the master plan and the mapping related to it. So he gave us the challenge, and we initially considered doing this as a project where we would hire consultants to come in and facilitate the process. But as it turned out, we decided we could do this on an in-house basis. And so the Campus Master Plan Committee took on the task as an in-house project to update the University Master Plan for the period of 2010-22. Now, it's a projected 12-year period that we are intentionally focusing on because we do our capital planning. We're going to really intentionally connect our capital plan planning with our University Master Plan. In that, when we talk about where our spending priorities for capital are going to be directly reflected and demonstrated graphically and described as part of our updated master plan. But our goal with you here today is to simply give you an update of where we are in this work in progress. It is not complete. And we're going to focus only on today, because of time and circumstances, the main campus. But we have provided you with some materials at your desk. We've even given you a pointer in the event we want to talk about something that's up on the board, and you can, and you'll have, and that's a gift from Planning, Design, and Construction. You can take that with you today, but you have that in case you want it, and we've given you a couple pieces of material that we will also have. But before we go any further, let me introduce the people who've been participating in the preparation and development of the updated master plan, and I've asked them to be, come today, and as chair of that committee, I would like to introduce them. Please stand when I call your name. Craig Biggs from our Athletic Department, Associate Director. Melissa Cantor, who is here with us as Assistant City Engineer from the City of Bowling Green. Randy Deere couldn't make it today, but a faculty member, of course, and a professor from our College of Health and Human Services. Neil Downing, Associate Professor of Architecture and Manufacturing Sciences. April Gaske, Coordinator of Academic Services and the Staff Council Representative. April here. Steve Hunter, Executive Director of our City County Planning Commission. Thank you. Colton Jesse, President of Student Government on our committee. Charles Jones, Director of Facilities Management. Brian Kuster, Director of Housing and Residence Life. Gary Mazzaros, Assistant VP for Auxiliary Services. Brian Russell, of course, Planning, Design, Construction. Dr. Eric Reed, from our Associate Professor of the History Department and Faculty Representative as well.
Home with his kid. That's school.
Okay. Right. Helen Severs, our Campus Landscape Architect. Helen. Jessica Steenbergen, our Scheduling Application Coordinator from Academic Affairs. Jessica. And Jennifer Tugas, our Director of Parking and Transportation Services. Now, that is a diverse group of people. I mean, really, when you consider we have student representation and faculty and staff from across all those divisions of the campus that traditionally need to be engaged when you have conversations about what are we doing today that we want to talk about changing for the future, and
city involvement,
as well as getting input and coordination with our Public Works Department in the city and our Planning and Zoning Department with the city. I want to compliment them for their willingness to participate, and we found it to be a very beneficial connection between the university and the city in that way. And I will add that we meet on Fridays at 7:30 in the morning, and they all come. So these folks worked on this. This is above and beyond what they would do as their normal duty. So this is a committee assignment that I commend them for their contributions and what they've done for us on this effort. In addition to their efforts, we've had folks outside the committee in the university that's contributed, and I want to acknowledge them. And Alfonso, are you here? Alfonso Cassano from Project Manager, Kevin Carey, Doris Hayes. Doris, I know you're here. Doris, she's our recording secretary, so when you comment today about what you see or anything today, then it can be added through Doris's efforts to our planning. Michael Hendricks, a student intern, has been contributing. Steve Newton and Hannah Sellers. Hannah is a student in our AMS program, and we will talk about more what she's done for us in a few minutes. But thank you. And Tanya Travelstead, also a planner from the City County Planning Commission, has been involved. So I guess what I want you to realize is that we've had a lot of people and a lot of work go into this in-house and with those in the community. There's the one big map that I was talking about. I gave you even one to take with you. I find it very interesting to look at. This is an aerial photograph taken just last month of the campus. And we will talk about in a moment the real significance of this map in terms of what it's going to mean for us. But when it comes to planning, we've had a 2004 map on the wall in our planning office. And it's a little difficult when you start using a map that's dated, or an aerial photograph that's dated from 2004, given all that has changed. So we now have a 2010, and it's been a significant contributing part to the update.
You know what the best thing about that map is? Everybody look at that map. Look real close. Over the last dozen years, and these are things that typically don't come to the board because they're just things we do, but we've replaced the roofs on nearly every building on this campus in the last dozen years. Look at those roofs. The hangar looked brand new.
Proud of them.
Now, let me ask you a question. You spoke about a minute ago in recognizing all the people involved in this project, which is many in number, and you had decided to do it in-house.
That's correct.
And which I think was smart. How much money do you think you saved?
Oh, mercy.
$250,000 would be a...
Neil,
$250,000 would be a... If we had gone out and engaged consultants to do comprehensive work as we're looking, that would be a
probably a small number. Figure, wouldn't it?
I'd suggest that's a very conservative number compared to what other my colleagues are doing in the country right now.
And if you had went out and got a firm to do it, they'd have still had to talk to you all.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are the very people that you cannot talk about making plans for the future without engaging all of the people I just talked about.
Yeah.
And so what we will not only talk about, and it's a perfect lead-in, is that Neil Downing and Brian Russell are going to walk us through the kind of things that we've been doing and introduce you to more of the details about what they have put into the plan, and that's the meat of the matter. So let's go ahead and get right into that and let Brian explain that.
Well, not to get a lot of real technical, but one of the nice things, this is not just an aerial photograph of our campus. This is part of a topographic mapping project that goes along with master planning, and when this is finished, and we actually got this on the 15th, and it really is just a photograph at this snapshot, but what the company William Stackhouse does, because of the technology that is available today, they are going to be able to provide to the university this beautiful 205 acres. They will develop in this GIS mapping. This GIS part of the program is a geographic information system program that they'll be building layers upon layers upon layers of information. So that information is going to be instrumental in helping us and others later on in the project to help us to identify how many square feet of sidewalks we have, pavement we have, where the manholes are, steam, trees. It's really almost infinite. But with that technology, they also can give us the topos in 1 foot increments, spot elevation. So there is a large, large list of deliverables from this company that actually come from that technology by just taking the photograph today. Most of us think of GPS is what's in our automobile today to get me to Nashville to the restaurant or to a hotel. And really the GPS technology was only available since 1978, and what it really does today is it's gotten so accurate that it gives you an exact position on our Earth anytime, anywhere, in any type of weather. So that is part of a tool that gives us exact locations. Well, you say, well, what does that mean to us? Well, it also stimulated the department and others that we now have 8 geodetic benchmarks or locations on our campus that can be used in planning some more in our for us as a a department, architectural department. We also have a GIS department, and we also have a civil engineering department. And when this goes a little further, all of these things that we're using as a tool to do this job are also going to be utilized by our students, by our faculty, by the facilities department, by the planning department. So we're touching a lot of pieces on our campus that's going to be utilized every day. So, but these are some of the sample layers, and obviously there's hundreds of layers that will be developed with this map and others. These are just some simple things: roads, sidewalks, pavement, utilities and trees, buildings, building use, planned building projects, actually land parcels. This also ties in exactly with what the city has, so we'll share that type of information. The city uses the GIS method of mapping also, and their maps match our maps. It's identical. This is our base map with the GIS technology that is being built in layers. It's a little washed out on the screen. I apologize for that, but there's actually the parcels on all the property. We can turn a layer on, show you every house. And when this system is running, and it does run, when you go to a parcel on our screen in our office, we know what the parcel number is, how large that lot is, who owns that lot. So there's a lot of information available that we can't give you on the screen, but it's a very helpful tool to all departments. But basically in this, we have the buildings that are currently located on Western's campus. The green areas are the actual property that we own currently. And then we have in purple, which should be pink, the affiliated Western Kentucky University properties. That would be the student unions, the sororities, fraternity houses, and things that support our students on an outside of our university. This is another layer that we just turn on. We've actually turned on several layers at one time. It talks about the high voltage, which is the southern loop. Now it's graphically displayed very quickly, so instead of a verbal description, you see that. The buildings that are in red, which are existing buildings today, and we've outlined those buildings in just a blue line, those are buildings that we're planning on, as funding becomes available, to do capital renovation projects to. Now, are we doing other projects today? Yes. We're doing roofing projects this summer. We're doing sidewalk replacements this summer. We're doing lots of other things that don't show up on this type of map. These projects typically are $600,000 and above. Typical project we're looking into is our DUC renovation project that we're right now just doing feasibility studies, looking at different sites. Actually, Colton and I and about 20 of us just came off a three-day, 7:30 in the morning to midnight tour, and we visited seven other universities looking at what the potential is of where we could go as a university at our student union. Some of the other buildings in our capital planning process in the future would be our College of Business. We've indicated a new building, which is our music hall. We have a future site location for our Honors College. We have the area that's being developed. It's what they call the Block 12 TIF. Brian Kuster and Student Life Foundation has future plans to do a development and have purchased the property along Kentucky Street. We're looking at an additional residence hall either there or potentially maybe in Bates.
Okay. Brian, on the maps we've got, are Block 12 and 13 misnumbered?
No, actually, I think that's the correct numbering. We've been referring to Block 12 as everything from what would be 12th Street on up to 14th Street, but actually the work is being done at what is actually Block 13 of the 10th, but Block 12 has come to talk, come to describe that whole that whole area.
Okay, both 12 and 13 under Block 12 designation. Yeah. Okay.
What we are defining as Block 12 for this illustration is between 13th and 14th and between Kentucky and Central.
But in the actual TIF layout, that's actually Block 13.
But once it's stuck, we just have to stay with it. There were so many, you know, there were so many references to it. That's why we're calling it Block 12. Okay. But that's the hotel, the parking garage, the alumni project, etc.
Yeah, that shows on here is Block 13.
Laser pointer, but yeah. What is that? That's the
that is the area designated for the hotel.
Okay.
In other words, we don't have a hotel design for the site ideally worked out yet.
Right.
But rather, it's just a retained spot, so to speak.
Okay.
Well, and it won't be we. I mean, that'll be the Downtown Redevelopment Group that will do that. Obviously, we'll coordinate because Aramark will provide the food service, and it'll relate to our conference center, alumni center, and to the parking garage. But we'll be engaged, but that will be a hotel developer will ultimately be engaged by the SPE2 single purpose entity the group.
Depends on what hat I'm wearing when I say those words. I'm on the SPE2 board, so it's a case of.
You got to remember where you are before you know who us is. One more question: the parking garage there, which is the actual Block 12. I thought that was going to be wrapped in housing.
Well,
it's not depicted.
Here's the garage.
Oh, that's the garage.
That's the garage.
That's a surface
wrapped.
Lot then in
and
actual
what you're
Block 12?
There is
that's
the,
there now. That's the garage.
That's surface parking.
Yeah, right. Okay.
This slide here represents, and again, I'm going to ask you to look at your presentation handout that we provided you. And Neil, I'll let you talk about the presentation map and the importance of that, but what we've added on this next layer it's supposed to be a light blue, are areas that have been identified as property to be acquired as it becomes available to the university, and the presentation map has that clearly defined.
Since 2002, the AMS Institute has worked with the Master Planning Committee to primarily engage students, which I brought Hannah Sellers with me today. The work that we do with the Master Plan really is fulfilling our mission as an institute. We engage students, we extend the academic lessons of the classroom to real-world projects, and in this instance, what you're looking at is we collected all the data that we've been talking about, the GIS, the various layering, as well as what we want to support on the next 12 years of the mission and growth of our campus. And we had this young lady, very talented architectural student, render all of that into a more presentable format. And what you see here, we utilize the same color coding and things to provide this, but since 2005, this has been the document that has been utilized for our public maps that we produced and shared with y'all today, as well as staying in the executive conference room with the president. John mentioned earlier, the impetus of the update of the 2010 to 2022 master plan came about because Dr. Ransdell was tired of looking at the 2008 map. So we are about ready to replace that in your company.
He also challenged you to do it in-house when John told me what we were going to cost to employ a consultant to do this for us. We can do that ourselves.
Absolutely. This is not the only thing the Institute's done. Certainly we update our maps and our ongoing graphic exercises for the committee, but in 2002, it was our Institute that built the Wooden Model of Campus. It was first utilized by this board, actually, in 2004. We're very, very happy to have such talented students like this that we can share for the group.
That map that's on the screen is before you. That's the one we had distributed to you. So you have two documents. You have the aerial photograph from 2010 December, and you have this presentation map of the main campus that is our primary reference point that our narrative in the plan will refer to. And as you can see from just these layers that we've put on it, as Brian was saying, we can turn on and turn off different layers. But at this point, this map graphically illustrates where are we today, where are we going in the next 12 years, where are we interested in potentially acquiring property as available. And so those are some very simple but very fundamental questions you got to answer. And how does it link and tie to your capital planning process as you make your priority? So we have interviewed the president in terms of his thought processes to incorporate them into this mapping. We have used the campus master plan from the past as well as the capital plan of the last 12 years. And we think when we come back to you, which won't be long, we'll be in April of this year, our six-year capital plan will be due for the next coming biennium. So we probably will not be able to. April 15, in fact, is the date that it's due. But what we will probably do is submit our preliminary capital plan to the state and then come to you at a June meeting and give you a report on what we've submitted to get your intake, input, and approval. And then, as you know, we may update it between that point and November. So, in other words, it's getting preparation for the January 2012 General Assembly. But it all starts now, so we're already engaged. We'll be coming to you in the future talking about the capital plan.
There may be land acquisition property transactions that we bring to you that will not be on this map in some unforeseen context or with some yet to be determined rationale. But for the most part, property transactions that we bring to you in the next few years are likely to be identified on this map in the light blue.
And this is a living document. And while it's incorporating the next 12 years, as we've seen in the past 12 years, the ongoing changes that occur far exceed literally the vision that we have, because as opportunities come up, we have to realign that vision to take advantage of those opportunities. And this map will be updated as those decisions change along.
Just comments?
This may be a crazy question, but it looks like to me on the north side, or the west side, I guess, of the railroad, yes, that there's property over there that might be, well, I can see it's targeted for acquisition, Mr. President.
You're talking about this piece?
Yes. And environs, and that area, it seems like that area is
that's about a 5-acre tract of undeveloped land, coincidentally, adjacent to the campus. And there was the odd shape is because at the back of it is a former rock quarry that's still owned by the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And there is one sole owner of that land. We've had more than one contact with him, but he's just not ready.
It is on the other side of the railroad track, so there are some compromises. If we would ever want to do something that would create pedestrian traffic back and forth, you got some real inhibitors. So we don't know what that would be used for, but you know what? Between now and 2022, who knows that might not be a building site for something.
Well, would it be out of the realm of possibility to have some kind of pedway over the railroad track? Would that be something?
Possibly. We studied that when we were looking at the property that, what's the name of the apartment? The registry is now located. We looked at a pet, and by the time you go high enough over the railroad track to meet the railroad standards for height and clearance, and due to the ADA, accession and dissension from that, it was going to be millions of dollars to build a proper pedway over that railroad track to make all the clearances and to meet all the ADA standards.
Yes,
now going under is a possibility too. That's pretty expensive, plus you got some real security issues when you do a tunnel under something like that. Just security cameras are one thing, but that's not fail safe.
Curious. The university had an opportunity about 20 years ago, maybe 25 now, to pick that up for almost nothing. That land's too bad we didn't move then. But
I think a car dealer had a part of that a long time ago.
Pardon me?
Wasn't there a car dealer over there?
Yeah. The second thing, Macchial, many years ago, looked into that. As they were widening I-65 and taking some of those bridges out, a major component of the cost of overpass is the steel. And the state was going to, the feds or whoever was going to let us have all that steel that came out of those bridges.
Well, when they replaced the bridges on I-65 over Barren River, Scott Murphy Daniel gave us all those bridges, and that steel sat somewhere over there for a year or two, and finally it just, the impracticality and cost, even if he had the steel donated, just made it impossible.
Yeah.
Or impractical.
CSX owns 35 feet above the top of the rails air rights, and you have to cover that. And then by the time you build a tower and ADA compliant elevators and ramping on both ends of it, the costs are staggering.
Yeah, that's what
I'm talking about. Lose railroad track.
It's a shame because it almost locks you on that side. You know,
we have identified that as a hard edge of campus, and if you see where the new buildings are being proposed, and this is in line with the president's vision, is it's unifying it with the gateway to the city that the TIF represents, and we feel that that's probably our best opportunity to grow, and we are hemmed in with the neighborhood here, as well as the Chestnut Street corridor, and we don't see it coming available in probably our lifetime.
Outside of the residence halls, I'm going to play with my pointer too here, Patty, good idea. Residence halls, residence hall, maybe at some point in a phase 3 or 4 down the road, maybe a residence hall or two here, maybe, we don't know yet. But academic buildings, 1, 2, this one's underway right now, the music building, and 3, and that's the USDA Federal Research Lab that will replace the North Wing of the Thompson Complex.
Benchmark funded, right?
Yeah, we don't know what will become of that. We have about $7 or $8 million in hand now with the Agriculture Research Service and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's about a $22 million building. So that's really in limbo right now, that Federal Research Lab. So in reality, number 2 priority on the capital project list following the renovation of Thompson Complex Center Wing, which is the first priority. This would have to be funded in some other way, and I've given you some briefing on that. That's yet to be determined. But most of the projects that you see, buildings that are wrapped in blue, red with wrapped in blue, those are renovations. So an awful lot of the work to be done on our campus will be renovation projects. So while we've renovated most of the buildings on this map, we still have a lot of work to do in the next dozen years to finish some renovations and to complete a couple new buildings, really, before we start heading down this way or before we do things on the South Campus, which still is a possibility to do things on the South Campus as well.
I would add that when we get through with the committee's task, we will have mapping and narration for the mapping for the main campus, but as also we will have a mapping for Owensboro, E-Town, Glasgow,
South Campus,
Research and Development Center,
The Farm.
All those will be eventually incorporated into this plan, and again, all done by an in-house effort of the Campus Master Plan Committee. So that's the goal for what we plan to do. This is an example of where we are for the main campus.
Great job. Thanks.
Thank you.
There it goes, John.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you again. Catherine?
Just remember what I said. I won't say it again.
Thank you very much. It's really wonderful to be here. And after hearing all these things today, I've been picking up every day in my now 3 weeks here the exciting things at WKU. And I'll tell you what I've told people all over the country. This institution, what's happened and what's anticipated, may be the greatest success story in higher education today. It's really remarkable at a time when there's been an enormous amount of economic problems and still all this great progress. I have some good news to report. I've been here for 3 weeks and I've managed not to get in the way of the great staff and volunteers who are raising money in our current campaign. Our goal at the end of the calendar year was hopefully to get to $175 million. We got very close, $174.3 million. So we're very close to being within $25 million of our goal. And a little over a year, year and a half to go. The staff has done a remarkable job. We have a great campaign cabinet, and It's been really an exciting campaign to observe from afar. Since July through July, from July through the end of December, we had $8.3 million in gifts. That's a pretty steady pace at this stage in the campaign. Often this is a stage where everybody is so fatigued, it gets so slow, and one wonders if we'll ever get there, but I see lots of energy. So the report is positive. We're very close to the end of this one, and after seeing all the master plan and other things, I know that we'll be doing the planning for another one. That's because you've had a lot of other things. I didn't bring a PowerPoint for you to see, but I'll be happy to ask questions if you have any or comments.
I think an important variable to track with this campaign, and you see the pages of particularly 42, 43, and 44, which break the $175 million down into programs, people, and places. And with all the work across campus, people often think, well, a lot of that campaign is just buildings. And it's really not. A very small segment, $38.5 million, of the fundraising for this campaign is dedicated toward physical places. Most are toward academic programs, and a major portion is people, mostly endowed faculty positions.
That's exciting because it shows the leverage of the private dollars is not going into things that will have to be renovated and replaced, and that is true. I love the fact that so much has gone into new programs, and scholarships remain a high priority, and I know the faculty who are here, the deans, we hope to raise more endowed chairs, professorships, and things of that sort. And certainly by the time we get ready for another campaign after this one's over, that will be, I'm sure, a very high priority to have. Our current endowment from all sources stands at $108 million now. It would be wonderful, and it's not at all unlikely that by the time the next campaign crawls along and is finished, we could be moving up into the $300 million range for endowment. So it's been a very exciting time, and it's fun to be part of that side of the equation to help other things happen.
There aren't many institutions that have now recovered from the recession, which the world is still dealing with, that have now exceeded a pre-recession level in their institutional endowments.
Yes, and in fact, I was just looking at the report that will be later presented to the Foundation Board, and the returns for this year on the average were back to 10.5%. Actually, some of the returns and some of the endowed funds are very high, 27, 25, 24%. That is a huge recovery compared to what a lot of other foundations are doing. So it's exciting and encouraging to see. And thank you for the chance to be here.
Thank you so very much. Media report, Robin.
Well, we have a little bit of a different type of media report for you this time than what you've typically seen. Usually we give you a packet of paper that has a lot of things run off on a copier. And today what we're going to do is a little, you have it on your flash drive. We're going to play a media report for you. It's the year in review of 2010.
There's a lot happening in a community the size of WKU. Public Affairs through the Media Relations Office helps communicate the news to the university's many audiences. A highlight of 2010 was the increasing and successful use of social media in the media relations communication efforts. The news webpage was replaced by a blog format featuring news releases, photos, videos, links, and other information. There were nearly 260,000 page views in 2010, up 316% from 62,400 in 2009. Media Relations also maintains the WKU News Facebook page, which grew to almost 24,000 fans. Posts are also sent as text messages through Twitter, which has 750 followers. Students especially turn to our website and social media to keep up with schedule changes, as shown by the nearly 9,000 visitors to our news page on Sunday, December 12th, when snow and ice were predicted. The Media Relations Office also assisted President Ransdell with establishing his Facebook page in 2009, and he already has 2,000 friends. Public Affairs worked with Information Technology to develop the IWKU application for smartphones. Social media plays a major role in the media relations communication plan. The changing landscape in traditional media means less space and airtime and more reliance on an online presence. Our aim was to become a source for news about WKU for our constituents, and we are pleased with our progress. And WKU received attention from the traditional media as well. From student and faculty accomplishments to international research initiatives to expert commentary, WKU has appeared in local and regional media as well as publications and broadcast all across the world. WKU's international focus has brought international attention. The announcement of WKU becoming the first U.S. partner with Navitus resulted in several stories throughout the year from as far away as the Sydney Morning Herald, Finance News Network, and The Australian, and in the U.S. from USA Today, Inside Higher Ed, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. That is in addition to local and regional coverage. Some stories brought the international element to WKU. The placing of Chinese teachers in local schools through WKU's Confucius Institute netted regional coverage in Owensboro, Louisville, and Cincinnati, in addition to the Northwest Asia news. The announcement that the World Council for Gifted and Talented Children would be moving to WKU resulted in regional coverage from Bowling Green, Louisville, and Lexington. The addition of a new provost to the WKU leadership team and his tour of the region garnered significant regional coverage in the Owensboro, Glasgow, Elizabethtown, and Bowling Green areas. Student travels often result in additional media coverage. When the Fijis biked across the U.S. to raise money for Alzheimer's research, their trek led to stories at many of their stops across the country. And a group of meteorology students chasing storms in the Midwest caught the attention of media in Mississippi as well as locally. A couple of faculty members have become media favorites. Political science professor Scott Lasley was quoted extensively throughout the 2010 election from The Washington Post to USA Today. Brian Van Brunt, director of the Counseling and Testing Center, was quoted on MSNBC and in the Vancouver Sun, among other publications, about ways students can relieve stress during finals. Events on campus also bring media attention. The announcement of a $1 million gift toward an alumni center received extensive regional coverage, as did the record amount of cash gifts for the year. And a young man's fight against bullying brought CNN to town to shine the national spotlight on WKU and the Kelly Autism Program. In addition to working with the news media, the Media Relations Office produces a weekly television segment called View from the Hill, highlighting many of the topics you've heard about in this report. Some of the most viewed features have included basketball player Jeremy Evans as an artist, construction of the new Gary A. Ransdell Hall for the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences, and a story on former Lady Topper All-American Clement Haskins. After the segments air on WBKO-TV, they are featured on cable systems in Glasgow, Owensboro, and Hopkinsville, and on Facebook, YouTube, and digital signs across campus. Audio versions air on radio stations in the Big Red Radio Network, Commonwealth Broadcasting, Cromwell Broadcasting, and many other stations throughout the region. Another service provided by the Media Relations Office is university photography. Many of the photos you see on the website and in university publications are the work of university photographer Clinton Lewis and his student worker Brian Lehman. There is a lot of good news at WKU, and the Media Relations Office in the Division of Public Affairs uses many mediums to make this news available to the public.
And there you go.
I like that report.
Good job.
Very good. All of you receive a daily clip sheet. I mean, you get an email that has a number of links to articles that are around the country and sometimes the world about WKU. But we thought maybe showing you a little bit from a more visual side, particularly the social media piece, the Facebook, the things that maybe you don't see every day, and what an integral part of our media plan that has become. So, good. I hope you enjoyed that. We'll do that more often. But you do have a copy of it. on this little flash drive that is at each of your places. And yes, Dr. Ransdell, there is space left, so if you want to use it for anything else, you certainly can. Little inside joke there. You also have on this flash drive our annual report, and I don't think, Gary, you've even seen it. Just in draft form. But this is the 2009-10 annual report. We'll run through it real quick here. I'm not going to point anything out just so that you see it. We will print a limited run of these, but we are going to push them out electronically and kind of see how that is perceived. Make it available on our website. And again, we will have a limited run of these that we'll use for certain audiences. But for the most part, we're going to try to see how it's received electronically first. So anyway, you'll have an opportunity. Well, you'll get a copy of this once it's run, but for now it's on your flash drive, so you can use that to read through the annual report. A lot of focus on students and student scholarships in that. And I do need to thank a few folks. The Media Relations Office, I think they're almost all here anywhere, minus one, I think. But Bob Skipper is our Director of Media Relations. Amy DeCesare is the voice that you heard in that video, and Clinton Lewis is the photographer, and then also Tommy Newton, who is not here today. And then I also want to give a special thanks to Corey Martin, whom you've not met, at least not in public affairs yet. She has been at the university for some time. But Corey joined our group, how long ago, Corey? A month?
November 1st.
Yeah, a couple months, as our Creative Web Services Manager. And we'll talk a little bit more about Corey in a moment. And then while I'm at it, Alicia, would you stand at least wave or something, but Alicia Carter has also joined our staff as the coordinator of marketing and web services. They both work with Stacy. Mm-hmm. But Corey put that thing together, the media report together for us. So you want me to move on to web now?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll move right in. And so you ask, why have we added these two folks? Well, they actually, these two folks replace three people. So we've downsized a bit by adding the two of them. We have undertaken a great project here, and I want to make sure you understand that it is not just public affairs. Information technology, Bob Owen and his group, and I'm going to recognize them in a moment, and the public affairs office have come together in a great joint project to convert our website to a completely new design. When Bob arrived in October, a little over a year ago, that was the first conversation Bob and I had, was how do we go about making our website more inviting, a little bit more accessible, more informative, and clean it up a lot. Our website had not undergone any sort of redesign effort in quite some time. So Bob was very open to working together on this. It's not a project that one division can undertake. We sort of have more the content and design side, where they have the really hard part, which is the architecture and all the things you don't see that make the website work. So what we wanted was to make a good first impression, to provide information that people are looking for, and to make it easy to find. So we did our homework. We put together a group of folks on campus that included faculty representation, student representation, representatives from IT, representatives from public affairs, and we sort of did a little due diligence in the beginning, trying to determine if this was an internal project or an external project. And we did actually seek from our marketing agency a proposal on how they might go about reinventing our website. Ultimately, what we decided is that we had the expertise and the desire to do this internally. And so we set about with two groups, a task force committee of technical folks on one side and content folks on the other, that included staff from both sides, also had faculty representatives on both as well, and students as well. We did some focus groups on this too, and got a little information on what we needed, what people wanted to find on our website, and how easily it is to navigate with the change. The people I really want to recognize, I've already pointed out Corey and Alicia, who've been involved in this project from a public affairs standpoint, but Stacy Biggs has, and she's going to go through this whole thing with you, but Stacy chaired the task force on content, and then Gordon Johnson, who stepped back into the room. Gordon chaired the technical task force, and Diana Keeling from IT have been incredible with their expertise and working together. It's really a great partnership, and it's nice that we could do it internally. We could have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this website project, and fortunately, we will spend much, much less than that. Our greatest expense will be on a content management system, but still under $50,000, I think. And then what we have in staff time, which is a lot for you all, I know. I believe that when Corey and I were chatting just a little bit, we have some million-plus files on our website that have to be either converted or done away with. So this is no small task. It will take months. But to unveil it for you now, and I will tell you that, the only other group that's – a few small groups have seen this, but this is sort of the official launch. It will go up live on February the 1st, but publicly today's the first time it's really been seen across the campus. So, Stacy?
Well, before I start, I just want to say that for most of you, this will be your first look at the new WKU.edu website design, and we're really, really excited about it. This was very necessary because our current webpage, which you see right here right now as the homepage, provides a lot of information, but there are some issues with it. Some of those issues are that it's very constrained in the design, so we don't have a lot of flexibility in being able to change things. It's very inconsistent across the entire website. So you can go to 20 different pages and see 20 different kinds of designs. And so we were trying to fix that inconsistency. And also, this is just kind of dated. It's stale. It's been the same for quite a while. I'm not even sure exactly how long, but it's time for an update. It's time for an extreme makeover. So with the new design, we're going to try to accomplish a lot of different things. We're going to address some things specifically like the consistency issue across every page so that WKU is properly branded, so that every page looks like WKU. There's no doubt what university you're at when you're on one of our pages. Also, ease of navigation. With that consistency, navigation will automatically be somewhat easier because it's so consistent across. You know where to look for certain things. Also, ADA compliance, which is not only very important, but it's the law. Our CMS that we have purchased, which is called Omni Update Campus, addresses that, and it forces every single page to be ADA compliant. And the other thing is SEO, search engine optimization, which makes Google much happier about finding WKU websites and all of the different pages that are within, too. As Robin said, our new site is going to be designed within a content management system, which makes updating the pages much easier, much quicker for folks, and they don't have to be web experts by any means to be able to make the updates. So hopefully that means that updates will be made very frequently and content will be kept very, very current. Our website is it's our window to the world. For many, many people, it's the first thing that they see about WKU. They go to the website first if they don't have any print materials in hand yet. So we want it to be very professional. We want it to be very informative, very functional, and we want it to be to meet their needs, and we've tried to address that in the new design. We've studied the research out there about what people are looking for when they come to a university website. As Robin said also, we did talk to prospective students and current students and parents and faculty and staff members to find out what they were looking for as well. So we want this to be focused on all of their needs, and hopefully we've been able to meet that. So I'll go ahead and show you just a few pages of the new design. Now, this is a demo site, so we just have a few of these pages set up that I'm going to go through with you for the tour. This is the new WKU.edu actual homepage. We have several different things going on here. We have a header across the top, which will actually be consistent on each and every page throughout the website. And in addition to that, we also have a static footer, which will be consistent across each and every web page. One thing that we found out from our focus group was that people like to see pictures on the homepage, but they want them to rotate themselves so that they can see different things going on. But they can also control the speed of the photos by using the individual control buttons. We've tried to group the links in the left navigational area so that they make a lot of sense. Hopefully, the way that we have these grouped in categories will make this very intuitive. So when somebody comes to the web page, they'll know without having to think very hard about it at all exactly where to find what they want to find. We have information for specific groups of people. If you go straight to something about academics, we have a section for that. for admissions around campus, which is just any number of things that people may be looking for, literally around campus, a research section, and a section on international reach. Another thing that we learned from our focus group is that once students, even if they've come to our website 10 or 20 times already and they finally made a decision to apply, they don't want to have to search really hard to do that. They want to be able to come to the webpage and hit a button and be there. So we have an Apply Now button on the homepage that is very obvious. They can't really miss it. And that Apply Now button can be put on other pages as well. And we have some interactive features such as some student stories, a news feed, events feed, and a media area video, which will typically be the View from the Hill, will be in that place right there. And we have a spotlight area, which can be basically anything that we want it to be. My idea for the spotlight area is that if we have something that needs to be announced to students, this one we wrote a little blurb about winter term, but it can be any number of things. If it's something that we need to announce to students or to campus, but not necessarily something that the media would pick up on, then we can put it in the spotlight area so that we are still getting the information out to people. So this is the actual homepage itself, and I want to show you an example of a landing page, which is basically kind of a wayfinding page. You can click on colleges and departments, for example, but obviously there's still other choices that you have on where you want to go. So here's an example of that kind of a landing page. And then we also have an example of a college-level homepage. College of Health and Human Services is the one that we have mocked up. As you can see, very consistent with the actual homepage design as far as the header that's at the top and the footer at the bottom. But the things that are in between at this point become very customizable. So everything that is between right here under the header and down at the bottom just above the footer is very customizable and flexible for each unit or for each college, for each department or division. They can fill in the information the way they need it to be. They have their own links. They have their own photos. They can have their own news and information feed here if they want to. Or this one we have, just as an example, centers and institutes listed. For CHHS, we have majors and departments. But again, this is just an example of how it could be. This is not how it has to be. It's all very flexible and very customizable so that each department can set this up to meet their own individual needs. Also, we have a departmental level page set up. The one that we have is the School of Nursing. Again, you see the consistency in design. Photo area where, again, they can put their own specific photos. A left navigational area to make it very easy to find out where you need to click next or what you need to find. On this particular page, just as an example, we put a welcome to the School of Nursing. We've got a news spotlight and an events section, but they could put any number of things there. If they would rather have a Twitter feed coming into that page, they can do that there instead, but it's up to them. And then we've got some other information here that we want to include at the departmental level. What can I do with a nursing degree? Training, salary, career information, those kinds of things. So we want to try to make this more about the students and what their needs are and what their expectations are. And another page that we have mocked up for you is a faculty and staff page. I really like this page. There are a lot of students out there who they want to put a face with a name. But who's going to be teaching me? What does this person look like? What can I expect when I get there? And so we wanted to have a faculty staff directory page where they could actually see people face to face. Because of this, as you can see, we're going to be needing to get a lot of photographs over the next few months. We're not going to force anybody to put their photograph on the website if they don't want to, but we are going to encourage people as much as possible to let us take a new headshot, put it on the website, so that we don't have a lot of these no photos available. What Corey is threatening people with is if they don't give us a photo, we're going to put Big Red in their spot instead. I don't know. We're still considering that. So this is what the faculty staff directory page can look like. And again, this is specific to the nursing department right here, but it'll be specific to whatever department you happen to be visiting at that particular moment. And then we can also do individual faculty and staff member pages. This particular page for Kathy Abel just has some little bit of information about her contact information and her bio, but we could also put on here research interests, what courses I teach, any number of different things that we can choose to put on this page. Again, that's where the customization comes in. Each person can choose how much or how little information they want to provide. So that's really all of the pages that I wanted to show you. But again, I do want to emphasize that I know that this looks a lot alike on a lot of the pages, and really that is very much on purpose because we want that consistency in design and the consistency in branding. On every page, if you click on the WKU logo, you go back to the homepage, which is kind of an industry standard that we haven't had that before. So we're trying to standardize a lot of different things, things that maybe should have already been done. They haven't been, but hopefully now we're going to address a lot of those. As Robin said, we are scheduled to launch the homepage design in February 1st. The phase one is going to be launched in three different phases, and phase one is February 1st, which will be the homepage, the public affairs website. We're kind of doing our own as a guinea pig website, so we learn a lot about the content management system. Also, the president's page, the Board of Regents page, and a few pages for the College of Health and Human Services. And then we'll go through some additional phases, training periods, and some launch periods. But hopefully when it's all said and done, we should be launched completely across campus no later than September 1st, if all goes as planned. So this has been a long project. We're still right in the middle of it, but when it's all said and done, it'll be about 18 months, something on that order. And one thing I do want to emphasize is that we're proud of this and we like the design, but the last thing that I want to happen is for this to get stale again and for this to, you know, 2 years from now to look at it and we're bored with it because it's exactly the same. I'm not going to let that happen. We will continue to make updates. We'll continue to add interactive features. One thing that I really am excited about offering in the future is an interactive campus tour. So that's something that we definitely want to do. And there's some other things coming down the line too. But I think when it's all said and done, it's going to be a much improved website over what we have now. And hopefully we get about 2 million hits on our homepage right now. Hopefully those folks will be able to find their way much, much easier. We've had an overwhelmingly positive reaction across campus. Most people are of the opinion that it's about time. We needed to do this. And we've also had a lot of cooperation and support, and I very, very, very much appreciate that. As Robin said, this has been a very collaborative effort with IT, And those folks. Eric and Dana have been great to work with, and Gordon, and appreciate everybody's support very much, and your support too, because I know you've been behind this 100% since the beginning. So I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has questions about the design or content or how we got to where we are.
A lot of decisions are made in an instant by going to a web page, and if you're not selling, you're not going to sell.
One of the most, if you're a person who does a lot of searches on websites, you know that you want to get to your information quickly. And if you can't find it quickly, you're typically going to go someplace else. So what Stacy and her team and Gordon and his team have really focused on is making sure that the most pertinent information is right there and readily available. So we think that this is a great start. We are very excited about this launch. The nicest thing is that we will use the data to drive what goes on this homepage in the future. So currently we've had some data through the Google Analytics, but not nearly enough, and we haven't used it effectively. This website and this content management system will allow us to know what people are looking at, what they're looking for, and how often it's being used. So this is a great place to start, and we'll be in much better shape on the external communications and what the internal user gets as well once this is launched and fully converted by the end of the summer. So thank you.
Robin, thank you. You all did a magnificent job. Very informative. Let us take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and finish up.